Athra Swaminathan, I'm Kumar here. We have not received any reports today, Tante.
Okay. So that means we can start with the sutta. So I would like to know, who is going to present the day's gata or the part of the sutta.
Yes, Swaminathan, I have that here.
Yeah.
I just have to quickly refer to my notes. Okay. So, in the Bhikkhu Bodhi book, it is Sutta. Well, it's the Tuvataka Sutta,
and
Tuvataka Sutta, and we are on verse number 925 this week.
Yeah.
And would you like me to read that, Swaminathan?
Yes, please. Yes.
He should be a meditator, not one with restless feet. He should refrain from regret. He should not be heedless. A bhikkhu should dwell amid seats and beds in lodgings where there is little noise. That's it, Swaminathan.
So that means these are the conditions we expect usually for a good meditation. But the sutta says you must not indulge them. You must expect or you must appreciate them. So therefore, is it a result of meditation or is it a basic requirement of the meditation is a question. You must have a solitude place with less noise and all the kind of thing. So, that's it. Do you going to earn them as a result of meditation or you must have as an opening balance? So, therefore, with that idea or keeping that in your mind, I would like to listen to the same. Please repeat what you read so far from the Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, please.
Yes, Swaminathan, that is, he should be a meditator, not one with restless feet. He should refrain from regret.
That means restlessness and the regret is a result of meditation, or should it be a opening balance to be a meditator? Usually we think that we keep on meditating, our restlessness will be reduced and that aggressive feet will be reduced. But it says, as a meditator, you must not have them. Mm. So can you understand what I am going to stress?
Yes, Swaminathan, then going into meditation, we should reduce our stress and regret before we begin to meditate.
This don't talk about the gradual part. It says, as a meditator, you must have no aggressiveness, no regret. So how to reduce the regret? How to reduce the aggressive part is not there because it can be considered as basic requirements. So that is because these talks are aimed at the celestial beings, aimed at born lucky people. So this is not a basic lesson for someone to start with. This is not the beginner's class. So once you get it, you must be a meditator and you must try to advance or proceed along these lines. So therefore, aggressivity and the regret, whatever you have, you must not entertain. So far, you are born with lucky conditions, no much of aggressivity, no much of regret. But even little thing you have, you must not entertain. So that means it is not beginner's mind. This is not the advancing state. This is advanced stage situation. And many people therefore think, of course, the commentator says, this is meant for celestial beings, but it is not directly mentioned in the sutta. So therefore, many people consider we are not qualified to become a meditator. We don't have these basic qualities, so they are waiting till them happen. But when as a meditator, when you are going, sometimes your mind is calm. Sometimes mind is agitated. Sometimes mind is the regret. Sometimes no regret, contentment. So whenever you have these ups and downs, whenever it happens, what must be your attitude? What must be your the forward plan? So whatever may be the conditions to increase the aggressivity and the tension, you must try to reduce it and increase the conducive condition for less aggressivity that you have and still the tension. And that is the Buddha, trust. You have your confidence. Trust. You have your ways and means. Don't ask Buddha, how can I reduce my tension? How can I reduce my aggressivity? Because your meditation, you see ups and downs. Calmness and aggressivity, tension and relaxation. So therefore, you making use of this situation, you must try to prepare your own concoction, your own soup, your own salad, so that you must have inferential knowledge. You must have rational knowledge as far as you have seen extremes to assimilate your synchronize, your balance. So when the balance happened, you know you are the sufferer, you are the doctor, you are the medicine. There is no second person. So that means it's not only for the advanced people. Advancing people also, they get the basic raw materials. Even one person sit for 1 hour as a beginner, he or she also can have it, but they can't comprehend it. Is this what the Buddha is referring? Am I so qualified to do? Am I so qualified to have calm mind and to reduce the aggressivity? Is it my bad luck to have aggressivity? So that is what we have to discuss. That is what we have to have interviews to tell you whether you are a beginner or a beginner, advancing or advanced. Everyone is having this combination. How to put them in a order? How to align them in a way so that you are advancing, therefore no one is disqualified. And no one is completely thorough, fully achieved. We all are in the same boat. You may continue the verse translation of Bhikkhu Bodhi, please.
Swami Nansa, do you want me to continue with the second verse?
Yes, please.
The next
please.
One?
Yes,
okay. Yes, Bhante.
No. You continue the same verse.
Same verse.
Only the
few. Yes, you had spoken of he should refrain from regret. The next part is he should not be heedless.
Yeah. So some people say heedless is mindfulness. And heedfulness is mindfulness. Heedless means the lack of mindfulness or negligence, not diligence. So therefore, heedfulness, earlier you think as a spiritual character and a the philosophical character. No, you have. Sometimes you are heedful, if you are even a beginner. Sometimes even if you are an advanced person, mind becomes heedless. So therefore, you have a hope. Sometimes it's a good balance, sometimes it's bad. So it's a matter of balancing. And with that idea, if you continue, you must try to make use the mean advantage of the combination, so that slowly, slowly, from the heedlessness to the heedfulness, gradual development will happen. So therefore, of course, the discussion and of course the opinions will be helpful, guiding you. But for that, you must have the confidence. You have the basics. You are with the potential. We call bhava sampatti. And even non-Buddhist, even cancer patients, even addicted people, they have. Because drunkenness and addiction is, they are very superficial. This quality that your potential as a human, oh, I will put it this way, whatever the bad thing you do, you still you are a human. Don't undergrade it by yourself or others. If it is so, you become a reptilian. You become a beast. So these things are society-imposed things. If you are living in an unsocialized place or living alone, these things are external. Your addictions and your cancer and your psychological wounds, they are happening because you are associating with people or civilized, or you are in a group. But when you go, here now I am, they are not, but still you are in a grip because the world is civilized. World will catch you one day. Therefore, if you wish to have tension and aggressivity, go to the people, go to the society. If you wish to have contentment and the heedfulness and the less aggressive, go to the forest. No one is fighting with you. Monkeys are there, but they mind their own business. So we, or meditators, are the people going to people and the societies and the organized world and the formulas and the technologies end up with tension. So therefore, we, at least those who are participating in the discussion, we know if you wish, we can go to the forest. If you wish, we can go to a meditation center. If you wish, we can close your eyes and sit down. Or if you wish, you can go and do some walking meditation. This is the way out. And fine-tuning only, still fine-tuning only, aiming to less aggressive or less the tense situation, the Buddha is giving you have the potential. You have the possibilities. So therefore, in the quantum physics and kind of thing, they say, as far as the human beings are concerned, everyone is equal in potential-wise, each one is equal with the possibility-wise. But our education is discriminating us. We are human. Don't forget about that. Other qualities are very superficial. Don't give extraordinary values for them. Then you are in trouble. So that's all what I have to contribute. Anyone who wish to...
Yeah, I might add, actually... This is Venerable Bhadrakata.
Good. Welcome.
So I always think the in Thai, the name for the monastery is a wat, and wat means a place of duty. So the opposite to heedlessness. I mean, heedlessness is a very important, a very pregnant word, because the Buddha's dying words were appamadena sampatita, to not be heedless. And a wat or a temple means duty, actually. Wat means duty. And it's a place of duty. So it's the opposite to being heedless. And so when you were mentioning about a monk has always got this opportunity to go to a monastery or something like that, it's more than that. A monastery in Thai means a place of duty. And I always remember as well, like Mahasi Yegata was a training ground, was a training place. And I value the opportunity myself to live in monasteries because, again, people will always say sort of things like, oh, you don't need to be a monk, or you don't need to live in a monastery, or you don't need to have the vinaya. You know, why we don't need these things. You know, we're able to do this kind of stuff at home. And, you know, fine, good luck if you can do that at home. But I personally find it very useful to have the support of the vinaya, actually, and the support of a monastery, and the support of a place in a forest, and the support of a community of monks around me, because it's helping me to not be heedless. It's helping me to do my duty. It's helping me that kind of constant effort, actually, persistent effort, which is the opposite to heedless. So we need to construct it's helpful to construct all of these supporting factors so that we can be not heedless. The default is actually to be heedless. It's automatic. It's free of charge. Whereas the real challenge is to construct supportive good conditions. It's the real challenge is to find the sasana. The real challenge is to stay as close as you can to the teachers and to the good opportunities and to the blessings. And that's the challenge. And if you can hang on for dear life, when you get that kind of a circumstance, then you have the opportunity to not be heedless, because automatically you will be heedless. And that's sort of the real challenge. So even though it's a short line, he should not be heedless. It's a very pregnant line for me. It's very deep and brings up all of these different aspects of not just the practice, but the conditions of practice, and that a monastery is a what. It's a place to be not heedless. It's a place for duty. And we focus a lot on avoidance, like discipline, meaning we don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. But there's the other side of it, the positive aspect of, look, we need to do all of these things. We need to be not heedless in all of these other areas. And again, a lot of people will say, I don't do anything wrong. I don't do anything bad. I don't do, I actually don't practice either. Or I'm not, giving it a good effort. I'm heedless. I'm like one of those workers who shows up and takes the paycheck at the end of the month, but they haven't produced anything. They didn't do anything wrong. You know, they were very, very good people. Didn't do anything wrong. They just didn't do anything either. They were heedless. So it's a real challenge. It's a really, I think to be heedful is one of the most really difficult parts. Like discipline, like vinaya, sila, is like, that's basic. I don't do all those bad things. But what do I do? You know, what am I doing? You know, am I being heedful? And am I making good use of my time? Am I a good worker? Upandita Syada used to really use that metaphor a lot about the lazy workers, the idle workers. And he would scold us and say to us when we were on retreat, he would say, you know, that the poor people of Myanmar were supporting all of us and we were not to be idle workers. He could really turn the screws that we weren't to be heedless. And balancing that effort, getting that effort sort of at a steady burn so that one burnt off the defilements is a really, it's really important. Anyway, that's just some thoughts about this expression, he should not be heedless.
Yeah, it is giving a new perspective, but as far as the duties, yakta, what, and ayatane, dharmayatane, bhavanaya, madhyasthane, this everything is a working place. So therefore, when you go there, you have free food, you have to free bidding area kind of thing, but you have some duties, otherwise you are not a member. But the duties wise, the Thailand aspect and the Burmese aspect and the Sri Lankan aspects different. We have different ways, and the too much of duties we call regimentation, and completely you are free, laissez-faire. So we accordingly we have different teachers, So therefore, we have to understand monastery means something. But if you are an individual, you can select Thai system, you can select Burmese system, you can select Sri Lankan system, or you can select within the monastery system. One thing I like to share with you all is, all the duties, Buddha tested, time tested, we can do mindfully. But outside duties, world duties, I mean the business and the other entrepreneurship and the industriousness, they are not assured for a beginner can do mindfully. Because they are vicious, they are enterprising, they are entertaining, and they are provoking sex, they are provoking money. So therefore, all the duties, even in the Nisarnavan, I have never been to Thai, but I have been to Mahasi centers, and they are different. And if you go to a Tibetan center, everything is tell you, you have to do this, otherwise you can't be. You have to learn something. You have to do something. But in Sri Lanka, any beggar, any mad person can go to the monastery, and the master, meditation master, must understand how to engage them. When you go to Kaduvela, people are coming, sometimes come for food. But anyway, when they come 2-3 days, they feel like doing. I'll give you an example. The one day when I am very seriously doing my computer work, a girl from age 6 came directly to me and offered me a paper. Then I asked, what? You open. She challenged me. It's a birthday card. Then I asked her, what is your name? You open it. I have written it. Okay. Then I asked, just what is your class teacher's name and the mother's name? Then she told, don't you know? My mother is the cook here. I told, I don't know. And she came. Of course, I had no chance. Then I asked Venerable Dhammavihari. He told, there was a flood. And he prepared free food. He go with the boat and fed whole family with the village gramasevaka or the village headman. And ultimately they felt we have to do something. They started to come with children, and children went to satipasala, and parents went to cooking. The whole family is now mindful family. So they come, and soon they come, Venerable Dhammavihari will assign, you are a mother, please go and cook, or you can do some stitching or sewing, or you can do gardening. So likewise, they select it. So therefore, they came because of the volunteer work, giving free food, and they come. And that is much efficiently happening in Tibetan country, Tibetan monasteries, of course, in America also, but they are poor people. They can come and get engaged. But ultimately, they are given mindfulness. And ultimately, this heedfulness and everything is just not for the work or productivity or worldly things. So, whenever Jnanarama used to say, all the duties in Nisarnavanaya, you can do mindfully. So, therefore, that I would like to add into Venerable Buddha Rakkita's work, the yekta, what, ayatana, dharma ayatana, anything means a working place. But all this work assigned to you is tested, time tested, and that is how the monastery is healthy, social distance, cooking, keeping the place tidy, everything happening, inflow and outflow happening, because it is meant for brahmacharya, meant for celibacy, and meant for mindfulness. So if you lost that essence, if you lost this heedfulness or mindfulness or diligence, it has become an asylum. It will become place for mad people. Many places, master is not so... Master is misleading people either for industrialization or regimentation, or appreciating the laziness. Do nothing. Of course, these are the extremes, but when you are practicing, you know how to do stressless way, how to use tenseless way. Because you are doing some kind of a sasana work. You are doing some kind of a yekta work or what or ayatana work. They are time tested. So therefore, I find many people are attending to duties or vata, it become a burden. I have done all the vata in Nisanavane, sometimes two, three together. I feel like tired, but I don't feel foreign. I feel like the family. So when I go to Panditarama or anywhere, with few days' time, I feel the familiarity. I feel I am not an external person because I do my job. And they are not asking me to be mindful while doing, but that must be my idea, to be heedful, to be mindful, to be diligent, and earn merits, earn skillfulness. That's all I have to add. Yes, Venerable, you can continue to read if there is no other ideas.
Okay, so next is, a bhikkhu should dwell amid seats and beds, in lodgings where there is little noise. So again, I take this as a reference to a suitable monastery or a suitable place to live. That we have basic necessities. We need food. We need clothing. We need shelter. We need medicine. So there's the basic necessities. And, you know, this reference to dwell amid seats and beds and in a lodging is a great, you know, it's a rare thing. When I came to this monastery, the hut I was assigned to, you know, to have the opportunity to have a forest, a hut in the forest was like, to me, it was like a great lottery that I had won. Because to have the support infrastructure, a place where I could receive dana and so forth, if coming from the West, it's a very rare thing. These opportunities don't exist in my home country. So I come and I live here in Sri Lanka. So it seems trivial, like, oh it's just a dwelling and a seat and a bed. But also it means, you know, the other supporting factors that come with that. And to have even a dwelling and a seat and a bed, if I look across the span of humanity and time, it's a great thing to have. So yet we hear we're told that a bhikkhu should have these things. And sometimes I think I meet some people who are quite harsh in their practice, and I call them the Boy Scouts. You know, they want to live out in the woods or the forest or in a very rudimentary state of condition. And when I look at this verse, it reminds me that I should at least fulfill the basic necessities. And, you know, I keep my hut in a good living condition and so forth. And it's a great support to my practice, again, to have a place that is suitable, that has little noise and distraction. And I can easily maintain my mindfulness and practice all the time. I'm not struggling. I'm not struggling with leakages, or I'm not struggling with like inhuman conditions. And I can put aside my considerations or thoughts about discomfort, or, you know, these the necessities are met, so I don't think about it anymore. It's I can put my mind solely on the practice and what I'm, you know, the mental activities rather than survival, and it's a great blessing. And of course, when it says with little noise, actually in the forest it's very noisy all the time, but it's a kind of a noise that's not disturbing. Maybe the word noise here is more referring to things that would be disturbance, whereas actually in the forest there's a lot of sound coming from the insects and the birds and the animals, and it's going on around the clock. But it's a noise. It isn't a disturbance. So it doesn't have to be perfectly silent, but it has to be just not distracting or something like that. So it's advantageous if one can, again, make that effort to find a suitable place and not be negligent about that. And again, when I took over that hut, it did require some work and effort. So I did put in a few months of, you know, mindfully repairing and returning it back to its full capacity. It was an old hut, about 50 years old. And now it supports my practice kind of effortlessly. I don't give any thought, really. I have very low maintenance with my hut because I put in that effort to bring it to a good state and a good condition. Again, if one is negligent and kind of lets, you know, doesn't take care of one's dwelling and seat and bed, and there's an infestation of insects or ingress of water or something like that, then it will be distracting, or it'll be not suitable. Whereas if one is heedful, then one takes care of one's dwelling. Again, many of the Vinaya rules for monks are sort of small rules related to how we should look after the property and how we should look after our dwelling and so forth. And then there's the regular duties within the monastery of cleaning and tidying a little bit around the monastery, so that it's we can put aside this basic requirement, this basic requisite of accommodation. And that's so once we establish a suitable place, and these days it's very, very hard in the West to even find a place because it's so expensive to purchase a property and have a dwelling and so forth. It's a huge, huge part of the expense. And so if we can have such a place, then we need to make use of it and honor the investment and to honor the rare opportunity. So it's balancing this privilege of having a place on the one hand, and on the other hand to not be like an animal in our practice either, and to not be too on the edge in our practice where we just haven't got enough adequacy. We're not human almost. That's what I think about when I hear this verse: a bhikkhu should dwell amid seats and beds in lodgings where there is little noise. But I'd like to hear what you have to say, Mahatero.
You have classic example. If you go to my room, such a mess. And I have a workshop and the lower this thing. But thing is that I am not there. I am now from Nathagani. And still I have a cave. Inside the cave, it's a mess. But right round, huge space. So I am keeping myself busy. But thing is, in my case, I am being a Mahathero. Many people are taking care. And they are concerned about the cleanliness and the animals and the leakages. And I am very thankful. And to explain you, I went to the Peradeniya on Thursday and Friday. Friday. And evening, I was in the Ayurveda hospital in the Pallekali. And evening came to Peradeniya, new place. And I wanted to make it a dwelling place for a new monk to stay. But it was a storeroom. There's no toilet. So he told that take few days. So we went to Gannarua, a new place. I mean, it is not mine. And I was dwelling there next day, whole day in Peradeniya Subhadarama. And 42 principals and one director from Kayagalla Ayurveda Hospital and some children. And the completely brand new the glass, the meditation hall, I can see my secondary school, I can see my primary school, I can see my university, I can see my postgraduate. So I thought like I am like a king, having all the facilities. So 4 o'clock I gave a sermon and came to Vijitapura So you can see Aukana great statue, you can see Vijapura temple, you can see Kalavava. And next day, so we had a lot of meetings about the Vijapura, and we were talking about universal village. The Sri Lankan concept told this of ideal place, but we have to develop the village and then start the sustainable industries as time comes, so we'll carry on. Evening we had the Satipasala, and twice went to Kalavava and have a dip, having the lunch while in the dip. Evening again we went to Kalavava, clean all around the Kalavava area we are visiting, collecting all the garbages and cow dung, and then came back. Next day morning we had the Uposatha day in Vijitapura. Soon we about to leave Anuradhapura, and one person came and showed us one abandoned area, another dwelling place with caves, seven caves, and statues, everything broken, and the people digging and looting all the things have done, and the utter forest. And it is having scripts, it is having the lakes, I mean, so small ponds. And after that, we went to Anuradhapura. We went to 6.5 acres. They have grown with the big trees. They are nicely happening. They are synchronized with the proper rainy season. Drip irrigation system laid, 7 miles of drip irrigation lines, not a single one used so far because intermittent rain. And then evening, we went to Anuradhapura just to find another abandoned school, 5 acres. And they are ready to give it to Satipasala, another dwelling place. Two rooms are working in the school. Others are used by the gangsters and roaming cows. And then came to Wayamba and had a discussion till late night. And today morning we started so much of work. And that kuti, I am living also, full of equipments and monkeys and water holes. So I am talking from the meditation hall. And therefore, dwellings and places, in my case, fast changing. But everywhere I go, I try to keep them intact. Of course, I sometimes mess them up. But lucky enough, my assistant and others, they know I am a messy fellow. But they maintain. Kandava Buddha Rakita knows very well about them. So still I am a happy person. I am not worried and carried away by the material surrounded. And I am using them for utility value. And for meditation, I try my best. How can I sit on a rock without a cushion? I try the lotus posture. When I lie down, I try my best to lie down just like Buddha. Very difficult. Very difficult. But that is the base for my back pain in the Singhaseya and all the other places. So therefore, your dwelling, your beddings and your this thing is physical, but your posture is the most important. If you know the posture, long time it takes how to sit on a rock. And even then, sometimes I fall asleep because of the imbalance in the mind. And lying down also, starting point is I can lie down just like the Buddha statue. But afterwards, crawling can happen. So therefore, the life is a lifelong experiment regarding the four requisites. This is talking about Senasana. That's the most expensive, you verily give the due value, because you can see in America, Philadelphia, New York, Mexico, not the Mexico, Seattle, how much people homeless? They do 2-3 jobs, still they don't have a dwelling. So there's no end to that question. But when you go to creep into a forest in Sri Lanka or like a monastery, you have to, even though you are using the Boy Scout in a inappropriate way, Boy Scout and the Girl Guide is the best. They know improvisation, they know impromptu adjustments. So therefore, if you are living like that, you are just like a bird. You are jumping from one tree to one tree, and wherever you go, there you are. You feel homely, and that is what I thought, but I know my life is very, very, very dynamic and traveling, but I am not prescribing others because it's very difficult to maintain the health and the other balance, unless otherwise you have this heedfulness, unless otherwise you know how to make use the beddings and the linens, because you must sometimes take a rest. Yesterday also on the way back, we jump into a lake. It's beautiful. Upper part of the water is so much heat. Lower is so cool. So you can have like a sauna bath. So that is the way you must try. And that's very dynamic, very challenging, and very, I invite everyone, please, don't worry about the luxuries and consumerization. Try to fit into this situation. The best one is the monk. That is what the Buddha is telling. And if someone can read the single version of that, would be better, because some of the people, those who are familiar with the Pali words, may get the notion. If that is not there, if someone is wish to talk, we can take a few minutes. And I have a lot of work, and I'm happy that I spent around less than 60 minutes. Otherwise, we are going to sum up the talk, sum up the discussion.
Swaminansa, Mahatero, thank you so much for breathing the life into the sutta, and to Bhante here as well, Irish Bhante, for making this alive for us. And I was just looking around. I don't see the Sinhala version here. But I just thought I would add a little bit based on what you're saying about being heedful, not being heedless, and seems the many things are coming up as far as what you all are saying about taking care of things, cleaning and taking care of the grounds and doing our duties. And that being a way of being heedful. And here in the Bhikkhu Bodhi's commentary, he mentions under the, he should not be heedless, he mentions one should be heedful in wholesome qualities. And then there was something else. Well, maybe that's enough. As far as refraining from regret, I think of that as also being worried, being anxious, being sort of divided and not whole, having a lack of wholeness, which often I think in worldly life we're often very divided, and we have our possessions that can be that we have to look after, and so there's a feeling of boundaries, and that we have to protect ourselves and what we own. And here Bhikkhu Bodhi also mentions under regret not to live with a mind rid of boundaries. So I just started reading the book No Boundaries, No Boundary by Ken Wilber, and so that kind of struck me there. And then along the next lines, so no boundary, and then also to be heedful in wholesome qualities. So particularly, I guess I wanted to say, I've noticed in the Zen practice places I've been, cleaning and work is a very high important part of our practice. And I think of also so wholesome qualities Mahatera is mentioning about to be mindful, to be fully engaged in our work. So when we're doing those works around the monasteries, grounds where trying to be mindful and being kind of brings up the image of no boundaries as well, because rather than being divided while we're doing our work, we're trying to wholly do that work without being unmindful. So if we're fully mindful, we are doing our work wholesomely, building up wholesome qualities, letting go of regrets, and becoming more pure in our mindfulness. And then naturally there's this growing purity and wholesomeness that we're trying to generate through being dutiful and doing wholesome works. So I've just noticed, yeah, and I think also I thought that if we are continually keeping our surroundings clean and keeping our upkeep of our grounds in the monastery so that things are clean and orderly. Also, you know, if we notice, if that's our practice, but then if we realize, you know, if our minds are if our minds aren't also orderly and without, qualities that are unwholesome. So when we notice that we have, let's say, greed arising in our minds or anger, well, that's something that's a defilement that needs to be uprooted. It needs to be attended to. We need to be aware that these qualities are arising in our minds. So there's a double level to this of keeping our surroundings wholesome and free of defilement, and free from disorderliness. But at the same time, you know, we have to realize, you know, we are practicing to be to become wholesome and to live with a pure mind. So I think that's the point of, we give up greed, hate, and delusion. We give up.
You are a usually lazy guy, but today's discussion you are very dynamic, and I hope also will balance. I am a very busy guy, very little discipline in talking. So therefore, yes, that your contribution to the discussion is increasing. We are very happy.
Yes,
and I hope accordingly you will increase your workload also, or dutifulness also. And I say you must be dutiful and you must be beautiful. Yes. I ask Venerable Buddha Rakkhita to take the balance of the discussion and take leave. I am going to take leave. Thank you very much for the participation.
Yes, Swaminanda.
Avasarai, Swaminanda, if you haven't left yet. Thank you, everyone, for the comments so far. And there was a verse that was discussed that, if I'm not mistaken, was about a suitable dwelling, you know, for monks. And so, you know, forest monasteries, you know, where, you know, the Vinaya standards are good. And, you know, forest monasteries, you know, out in the forest where the Vinaya standards are good. And, you know, it's, you know, away from the hecticness, one could say, of society. Those are suitable, you know, environments for monks to practice in. Not that, you know, one doesn't ever want to go to, say, cities or other temples or other monasteries, but, you know, staying in those environments long term could have, you know, a detrimental effect on one's practice. So, you know, forest monasteries, you know, out in the forest, you know, where the Vinaya standards are good, where, you know, it's away from the hecticness and chaoticness, one could say, of worldly life and society. You know, those are suitable environments for monks, and certainly for junior monks, you know, ones who are supposed to be living in Nisaya, you know, dependency. Those are, you know, the most ideal environments, you know, forest monasteries where the Vinaya standards are good, you know, that are out in the forest. And, those are the most suitable training grounds, one could say, for junior monks who are supposed to be living in Nisaya or dependency. So that's my comment.
Well, like I would sort of I remember growing up as a boy. I grew up in a rural area. I know Mahatero likes to boast about how he's a bumpkin, but as he mentioned, he was overlooking his primary school and secondary school and university and postgraduate school from one location. And those of us who know Sri Lanka well enough know that Peradeniya is not a bumpkin area. But I truly came from a bumpkin area where if you look, you'll just see mountains all around. And even when I go back, I sometimes struggle to understand some of my neighbors because their dialect and accent is so strong. And even when I ask my fellow neighbors that I do understand, do you understand what your neighbor is saying? And they'll say even they struggle to understand what they're saying because they're really quite bumpkin. And my point is that I had to kind of grow from this wild place into a civilized place as I went to towns and schools and then into universities. And then when I travel and move around the world, there's a kind of a universal civilization that's required if you live in cities. If you live in London, if you live in Melbourne, if you live in Paris, there's a kind of a civilization in a certain way of getting along with other people. And having lived in migrant countries like Australia, Singapore, you know, I've lived in migrant areas like London and the various cities like in Silicon Valley in California. You really have to get along with other people and have a lot of latitude to the different behaviors of different people. And this is a kind of, you know, rubbing shoulders with people, as it were. So in a weird way, if you become more and more engaged in meditation, you start to move in the opposite direction, out into the forests. And again, I've experienced, you know, living in monasteries, helping junior monks and lay people who visit, they can be very fearful of the conditions of the forest, the animals and the whole condition. I'm quite surprised. I often get villagers and people who are visiting the monastery, local Sri Lankans, and they come and, you know, they're very concerned about, you know, what about the snakes? What about the animals? Will they terrorize your, you know, life here, living where you do? And I have to kind of reassure them that it's fine, you know. And like I have circumstances that most people would consider quite difficult, like, you know, going into my hut and having to encourage a very dangerous snake to leave my hut. And just being, you know, where mindfulness is a basic survival skill, where you don't step on some dangerous animal accidentally, you know. And that I be vigilant around my anxiety or fears or concerns when I hear a strange sound in the forest, or that I get familiar with the noises and the sounds of the forest. So it's a very strange process where, as a bumpkin, I moved into, you know, city life and university and all of these kind of things where there's rubbing shoulders with other people and understanding the anxiety of dealing with other people and different people and different ways, and then this different kind of flow of moving into living in a rural area, into a forest monastery and a forest dwelling. And like we do have this necessity of dwelling, this is like a very fundamental necessity. Like it has to be adequate, it has to be suitable. And then on the other hand is, finding peace and practice. And I was showing some villagers yesterday, they came to my hut and I was showing them walking meditation. And I was explaining, this is something you can do in the village. This is something you can do in the office. This is something you can do in the city, is to do walking meditation. And, they were telling me, oh, how easy it was to practice where I live. And I said, yes, it's true. But nevertheless, we can do this wherever we live. So it is very difficult to be one of these mendicant monks who is constantly traveling. I have in my life as a monk traveled constantly, moving house, moving location, extremely frequently, within a month or less than a month, move country. I've lived and worked in over 12 countries. More than 12 countries I've lived and worked in. But sustained a long period of time in 12 different countries. It really takes a tremendous amount of adaptation and at the same time getting down to universal human qualities of decency, civility, not being a nuisance with other people, not leaving my possessions or things in a way that was hampering other people or annoying to other people, like not to have a big footprint, while at the same time not disappearing and not being, not being like a curtain to disappear into the background. Where you are yourself and like I appreciate the gift that this personality or that this person is. So not to be bland or gray. So it's a really an interesting challenge to dwell, to find suitable dwellings and to live suitably as a monk. And as my colleague just mentioned, it is very useful for junior monks to undergo the training to come in to live in the forest. But it is also a very difficult challenge for them, and it takes time. The Nisya period is normally suggested to be about 5 years. But because there's a lot to learn, there's a lot to adapt to, and there's, a huge change when you come from living in an urban environment to living in a rural environment. Again, I've experienced with many lay people where, they've never planted anything, they've never grown anything, they don't know how things work in that way because they've never known. They've only just known a rural life. If they want food, they go down to the store, they buy it, they cook it, that's it. Whereas here in rural Sri Lanka, you have to grow it from start and the seasonalities. And things are not available all year round. Things are only available in season. And it's a really an interesting challenge to adapt, to find a suitable dwelling that's suitable to that location and place, and to live in it and to adjust oneself to it. It's a really interesting challenge. And the noise factor is also interesting too, where every location has its own unique sound, and adapting to that sound is a really interesting challenge. Where because sound is the most instantly triggering thing for fear or anxiety or surprise, if we hear a sound, and to adapt to that sound and to be at home with the sound of that location. It's a very interesting thing how every single location in the planet has a different sound and not something we notice. And every location has a different environment, and what is a suitable dwelling in one place can be quite unsuitable in another place. And I've seen that. I went to visit a Sri Lankan monk who was living in Ireland, and he was quite strict about having just two robes. And it was winter time, and the house temperature was at 23 degrees or more. And I thought this is going to cost a fortune because I was wearing winter clothes myself. I was wearing thermal underwear, and I had many layers of clothing on under my robes. And he was quite surprised that I was able to take a bus to visit him because there was a bus pass. I could have a pass. Whereas he thought that devotees should drive him places. And it really collapsed in the end because it was so expensive to run, I think. Whereas I had to adjust my own behaviors and norms for the dwelling in that area, in that place. And it's a real challenge to live and move to different locations. If you look at it around the world, that's a real challenge. So to be a monk wherever you go is a deep practice. But as our junior monk had mentioned, it starts with having a basic foundation of knowing what peace is and finding peace in your heart wherever you go in the world. Okay, maybe we need to finish now. Okay.
But I'll try to make it quicker. Okay. Thank you, Swami Nanta, for those comments. And one other thing I wanted to say is that it's good to be in Asia, you know, as a monk, just because you get opportunities here that you're not going to find in the West. Not that, you know, one can't or should not be a monk in the West, but, you know, even in the U.S., you know, where there are actually forest monasteries of the Thai forest tradition specifically, I visited one on more than one occasion. Even there, you know, in the West, where we do have, or at least in the United States, where I am from, where we do have, you know, actual, like, you know, temples and monasteries and even forest monasteries, it's still kind of mixed. At least from my perception, you know, it's kind of like mixed up a little. You know, some teachers, you know, seem to be, this is, again, may just be my perception of it. Other people may have a different opinion, but some people seem to be teaching, you know, the retreats, you know, maybe focusing on retreats for like lay people and stuff. Some, you know, monasteries, you know, they're more focused on sila, you know, like vinaya, you know, and some monastery. Then I was involved in a group that was essentially all lay people, you know, and that was at a Sri Lankan temple in Washington, D.C. So it's kind of like mixed up in a sense. I spent some time at a monastery in Southern California before I came here. I was there for maybe like 3.5 months, a little longer maybe. But around that time, 3.5 months. You know, my teacher there, he was my main teacher there. He was Burmese. And, you know, we had Burmese supporters and we had Vietnamese supporters as well. And it just felt a lot more complete there. This wasn't like a super wealthy monastery, but, they had enough support from what I could tell. And it just felt more complete, you know, in the West, you know, there may not be so much of a culture of dana or generosity either. So, I kind of feel like this may just, again, other people may have a different opinion of it, but it kind of feels like kind of mixed up in the West, you know, where some people teach, you know, where some monasteries may have, or, you know, some teachers may be teaching like retreats for lay people. Some people may be focusing on sila or vinaya. Some people may be focusing on, maybe they focus on something else. You know, it feels kind of mixed up. Whereas in Asia, you know, like in Sri Lanka, you know, this country has been, predominantly Buddhist country for many, many years. And so it feels in Asia a lot more complete. The path of Dhamma feels a lot more complete in Asia. So in Asian countries like Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand. So that's all I wanted to say. And that's all. Thank you.
So we just shared the merits of our practice and our discussion today. So just wish you all to think about not being heedless and feeling that calm and peace instead, and that hopefully these words have been of assistance and give you some ideas of the kind of discussion the Buddha was having 2,500 years ago. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.